All right, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was On the Ground with Esther Everam, and that's heard Fridays at 5 p.m. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News coming up. Here we go.
Good evening. The Democrats debate again a veiled threat against a congresswoman. Gays move to legalize gay conversion therapy. It's because of the courts and 40 years since the H-bomb secret was published. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Friday, September 13th, 2019. Democratic debate night number 3, attacks and counterattacks, love for one former president, loathing for the current one. A 76-year-old frontrunner essentially got called old, and he turned around and called another rival a socialist. But will it change the fundamentals of a nominating fight that remains remarkably stable at the top with 5 months until voting begins? Here are some of the highlights from the 10 candidates who earned the right to be on the stage last night.
It's time to trust ourselves more than our politicians. That's why I'm going to do something unprecedented tonight. My campaign will now give a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for an entire year to 10 American families. Someone watching this at home right now.
The senator says she's for Bernie. Well, I'm for Barack. I think the Obamacare worked. I think the way in which we add to it, replace everything that's been cut, add a public option, guarantee that everyone will be able to have affordable insurance, number one.
We all owe a huge debt to President Obama, who fundamentally transformed healthcare in America and committed this country to healthcare for every human being. And now the question is, how best can we improve on it?
And I plan on focusing on our common issues, our common hopes and desires, and in that way unifying our country, winning this election, and turning the page for America. And now, President Trump, you can go back to watching Fox News.
In the United States of America, we are spending twice as much per capita on health care as the Canadians or any other major country on earth.
It's America.
Yeah, but Americans don't want to pay twice as much as other countries. And they guarantee health care to all people.
Your plan would
not. They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
Would not have to buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47.
Things that are important, things that are unimportant.
You know, as a military officer serving under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and as an elected official in the state of Indiana when Mike Pence was governor, at a certain point, when it came to professional setbacks, I had to wonder whether just acknowledging who I was going to be the ultimate career-ending professional setback. What I learned was that trust can be reciprocated, and that part of how you can win and deserve to win is to know what's worth more to you than winning.
And those were the candidates last night: Andrew Yang, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Bernie Sanders, Julian Castro, Beto O'Rourke, and Pete Buttigieg. Biden took the most fire, but parried it. Senator Bernie Sanders faced sharp criticism about his universal health care plan from several candidates, but his base has demonstrated its loyalty. Senator Elizabeth Warren was more in the background than in prior debates, but she closed with a compelling personal story. Senators Kamala Harris and Cory Booker were both crisp, but got lost on the crowded stage at times. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former Representative Beto O'Rourke and Senator Amy Klobuchar offered pragmatism and civic-mindedness. Andrew Yang, a tech entrepreneur, spoke eloquently about immigration and proposed to give 10 families $1,000 a month from his campaign. The normally mild-mannered Julian Castro, a former housing secretary, decided that attacking Biden, often in personal terms, was one way to get noticed. The likely result? Little change in a primary that has been remarkably static for months. It didn't take long for the fallout to be felt, though. The controversial moment in the debate not only wasn't between any of the candidates, but targeted a freshman Queens, New York congressperson who's too young to run for the office. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was burned in effigy in an advertisement run by a pro-GOP PAC that had her brand of that said that her brand of socialism kills people.
This is the face of socialism and ignorance. Does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez know the horror of socialism? My father was minutes from death in Cambodia before a forced marriage saved his life. That's socialism. Forced obedience, starvation. Mine is a face of freedom. My skin is not white. I'm not outrageous, racist, nor socialist. I'm a Republican.
Ocasio-Cortez tweeted several responses to the ad. One tweet said, GOP's message, no policy, no facts, just displays of violence and corporations like at ABC Network and Sinclair who amplify them. They profit from burning my likeness on TV, but who pays for heightened security? Who answers the phones for the threats resulting from a violent false ad? The editor of Extra, the magazine of the watchdog Fair, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Jim Narikas, says the ad was a violent threat meant to target the representative in the minds of Republican supporters.
It's stunning. It really comes across with the face bursting into flames, revealing skulls behind it. It really comes across as a death threat.
Is that what you felt when you saw it?
Yeah, it's chilling.
How does this rate in the type of attack ads we've been seeing this time around and in regards to the history of this kind of phenomenon?
There is a long history of the Republican Party trying to demonize its opponents. There is a real danger of that kind of messaging, especially when you are telling people essentially that your enemies are going to kill you, which is pretty much the explicit message of this ad. You are prompting people, unstable people, to take action against this, what you're telling them is a threat. It's putting the lives of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in danger.
Is this a new thing as far as these kind of ads actually advocating a violent attack in a sort of offhanded sort of way?
It's something that we've definitely seen from talk show hosts on the right. This is kind of their stock and trade, is whipping people up, convincing them that whoever is being held up as the threat du jour is an existential danger to them. This is how you keep people glued to their radios, is by telling them that their lives are in danger. So that's a good way to sell weapons if that's your business, if that's who your advertisers are. But in terms of advertising, I think it is unusual for a candidate to make that kind of my political opponent is a threat to your life. It's kind of unusual, but it's borrowing language that is very commonly used on the right.
As you said, it can endanger people by, how does it do that? But does it stir up mentally deranged people? Does it just put a target on somebody's head for violent supporters of the other side? How does it do that?
People might be unbalanced. So I don't think it's necessarily a question of mental illness. I think that people are able to convince themselves that they have a rational reason to believe that a political enemy is a threat to their lives. They're able to, I don't want to say it's reasonable, but it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily have to be insane to fall for this kind of propaganda, where an equation is being drawn between the politics of a person on the national stage and you and your family being killed. This is a logical step-by-step formula that's being laid out for you. And of course, it's spurious, but people who are swept up in the emotion of righteous anger and fear could take action against the people who they're pointed at.
What is the antidote to something like this?
People have to view this kind of putting a target on your political enemy's chest as really something that's beyond the pale. It should not be acceptable language in the political platform, because you really are putting people's lives in danger.
What do you think this bodes for the upcoming presidential campaign as it heats up?
Donald Trump has been a master of the politics of fear and anger. And I think that in order to try to maintain his hold in the White House, he will whip that up to as high a degree as he's capable of. I would not be surprised to see this kind of imagery being used on the presidential level as well as on this more...
You see more of the same, more and worse.
Yeah.
Jim Narakis is the editor of Extra, the magazine of the watchdog Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. The New York Times and CNN will co-host the next Democratic debate near Columbus, Ohio on October 15th with the possibility of a second round one night later. The DNC announced Friday that the debate would be held at Westerville, Ohio on the campus of Oderbin University. The moderators will be the CNN anchors Anderson Cooper and Aaron Burnett, as well as the Times national editor Mark Lacy. So far, 11 candidates have qualified for the debate. The 10 Democrats who appeared in Thursday night's debate, as well as the businessman Tom Steyer, who recently qualified for the next one. Other candidates have until the end of the day on October 1st to meet the qualifying standards. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In local news, the New York City Council has moved to reverse the 2017 ban on conversion therapy in order to prevent a Supreme Court challenge. Corey Johnson, the Speaker of the Council, who is gay and HIV positive, introduced the bill on Thursday. The Alliance Defending Freedom filed a lawsuit challenging New York City's ban, saying it violated free speech and was the first in the nation to censor speech, that's in quotes, between counselors and adult patients. The city bill would have banned the use of conversion therapy for adults. A state law remains that bans the practice on children. State Senator Brad Hoylman, New York's only out gay senator, says the legal climate is less favorable at the federal level for the LGBTQ community. He spoke recently with WBAI.
Gay conversion therapy, as it's known, is a discredited practice by therapists and social workers and others in the field of psychology, whereby they try to convert gay kids or trans kids or kids who have questions about their sexual identity or gender identity into being straight. It doesn't work. It's very harmful to children, to say the least, and it makes kids and adults feel less than perfect by suggesting that they need to be cured of their LGBTQ status. Currently, in the city council, they are taking steps to repeal a law that they passed over a year ago that is thought to be too broad because it applies across the board to both adults and children, as well as to anyone who might be trying to practice so-called conversion therapy, even those who aren't licensed by the state of New York. But fortunately, in New York State, I helped pass a law this session that bans LGBTQ conversion therapy from the practice of licensed therapists on children. That law is constitutionally sound and has been tested in the federal courts in California. And we specifically tailored the New York law after the California law. So LGBTQ conversion therapy or sexual orientation change efforts are still illegal in the state of New York as they apply to licensed therapists and children.
It was the possibility that the Supreme Court might say that you could not ban this practice as far as adults.
Exactly. We were concerned, as were legal scholars in the LGBTQ area, concerned that if New York City's law was repealed, it could undermine efforts to ban sexual orientation change efforts or gay conversion therapy elsewhere in the country and set a bad precedent, especially given the fact that the courts at the federal level are becoming more right-wing as Donald Trump has appointed more judges.
How has it happened that adults wind up in conversion therapy in the first place? You would think you would be pretty established in who you were by the time you were an adult.
You think you would, but some people have a hard time coming to grips with their sexual identity or their gender identification, and it can be very difficult to come out for some people. So a lot of these so-called conversion therapists are basically snake oil salesman trying to sell something that they can't do, taking advantage of people's biases, oftentimes going to parents who are just trying to do the best for their kid. They may be, for example, coming from a religious background. But these so-called therapists have nothing to sell, but really are undermining a child's self-confidence. And in the case of an adult, that too.
Did you watch the debate last night?
Yes.
What did you think? Is there any candidate you like?
It's a very strong Democratic field. I think they all spoke to different issues very eloquently. And I think we are blessed with a wide range of choices at this stage in the primary. I haven't yet decided myself, but between the policy and the passion and the gender and ethnic diversity, as well as the first openly LGBTQ candidate in Pete Buttigieg, I'm very pleased of my party. I'm a Democrat and think that we're going to field a strong candidate to defeat Donald Trump and push a progressive agenda forward.
The reason that the city council has to back off this bill is because of the change in the court, right?
That's right. Donald Trump has appointed more right-wing judges than any president in modern history. And we have to prepare here in places like New York, where legal challenges might take place, or elsewhere, where the courts could even be more conservative. So New York has to do its part to pass the strongest laws possible to protect LGBTQ people, as well as immigrants and women and people of color and those who are disadvantaged because of income. And at the same time, we have to be mindful of this court system, which is trending to the right and might try to attack laws that we pass here in New York City and New York State and try to overturn them on constitutional grounds.
State Senator Brad Hoyleman of Manhattan, New York's only out gay senator. In more local news, the MTA is hiring 500 new transit police officers. The agency says the move is aimed at cracking down on violence and fare evasion on subways and buses. Previously, the MTA has said it's losing hundreds of millions of dollars from people choosing not to pay the fares. The new officers will replace NYPD and bridge and tunnel officers who were reassigned over the summer. Union officials say assaults on subway workers are up nearly 40% from last year. The move will be paid for in part with $40 million that was provided by Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance. And chaos ensued in Manhattan Thursday afternoon when a cabbie allegedly clipped a teen who was running through a busy intersection along 8th Avenue. Police and witnesses said about 3 p.m., the teen who had just gotten out of a nearby school was hit by the yellow cab at 8th Avenue and West 52nd Street in Hell's Kitchen. Amid the mayhem, two panicked passengers in the cab fled as medics worked to rush the teen to Mount Sinai West, where he was reported in stable condition. An angry crowd gathered at the scene and school safety agents intervened. The safety agents used pepper spray to combat the fracas, said witnesses. Three safety agents were injured in the encounter. Some of the crowd also jumped on the hood of a separate yellow cab that was not involved in the crash. Police are still investigating the incident late Thursday. And finally, 40 years ago this month, a small but historic monthly magazine called The Progressive became only the second publication to have a story banned by the federal government. The first was The Washington Post for the Pentagon Papers. The Progressive was attempting to publish The Last Secret of the H-Bomb. Bill Loiters is editor of The Progressive. He's author of An Enemy of the State, the biography of the late editor of The Progressive, Irwin Knoll. He spoke with WBAI earlier today.
The Pentagon Papers case was the first time in U.S. history that the government tried to block publication of material on national security grounds. In the Pentagon case, Pentagon Papers case, obviously the government failed. They came back with another try in the Progressive case in 1979. And then therefore, for a period of more than 6 months, the Progressive was enjoined by law from publishing or otherwise disclosing the contents of an article regarding how hydrogen bombs are designed.
How did that article come to be?
A freelance reporter named Howard Moreland, who I'm going to meet up with later today, he's coming to town for a commemorative event that's happening on this at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Howard Moreland went searching for information about nuclear weapons using the resources that were available to him and a tour that he was provided of some nuclear facilities. And in the course, his goal was to uncover a somewhat of a secret, a mechanism that is involved in the explosion of a hydrogen bomb. And he did find what was the secret. The government learned that the Progressive magazine was about to publish an article about this, and it brought an action against it in federal court in March of 1979. That action did lead to the issuance of an injunction. That injunction was in effect all the way into mid-September, just around now, 40 years ago, when the government abandoned its case, dismissed the case against the Progressive, and the article was allowed to be published.
Was the issue really the secret? The secret itself wasn't that big of a secret, in a way.
The secret is that there was no secret. The secret was that this whole idea that there needed to be this pervasive layer of secrecy over anything having to do with nuclear weapons served no real deterrent purpose in the world. It merely served a repressive purpose, and it kept information from the public to prevent an honest discussion about the United States' nuclear program, its capabilities, and its wisdom, or I should say its lack of wisdom. And so the goal of the magazine in publishing this wasn't to endanger national security. That was never an option from this part, from the information that was disclosed, but to challenge the mystique of secrecy which attended to the nuclear weapons program of the United States.
What effect did that have on the Progressive?
It was expensive. I think there was more than $250,000 in legal costs, which was quite a lot of money in 1979, that was racked up in the course of defending the Progressive against this case. The ACLU did step in and offered free legal assistance, but it was only part of the Progressive's legal defense team. Remember, what happened here was that the entire force and might of the United States government was brought to bear against a tiny political magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, with a staff of less than a dozen people and really nothing in the way of financial resources to defend against a full frontal attack on its right to publish. And yet it did. It stood up to it. It fought back. It pointed out the absurdity of the government's position to try to block access to information which was readily available in the public domain, in which the government was forced to concede. The case fell apart because it became so apparent to all that the information was readily available in the public domain that the government had no leg to stand on in trying to keep certain information secret. It had to abandon its case, and 40 years ago, that's what it did.
All right. Anything you'd like to add?
The Progressive magazine is alive and kicking. The issue that is most recently come out and is available on our website contains a story by myself about the H-bomb case in commemoration of its 40th anniversary. Become a subscriber. Become part of what the Progressive has been trying to do for 110 years.
Great. You're like one of the oldest around.
We're one of the oldest continuously publishing publications in the United States. Certainly among the political publications, we've outlasted most of them.
Bill Loaders is editor of The Progressive. He's an author. He's the author of An Enemy of the State, the biography of the late editor of The Progressive, Erwin Knoll. And in just one more last story, European countries backing the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran say rising tensions underline the need for diplomatic efforts towards de-escalation and resumption of dialogue. A joint statement Friday from Germany, France, Britain, and European Union foreign policy and Chief Federico Mogherini voiced deep concern over Iran's latest actions. This week, the United Nations Atomic Watchdog confirmed that Iran is preparing to use more advanced centrifuges, another breach of the limits in the nuclear deal that is slowly unraveling after President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from it last year. And that's some of the news for Friday, September 13th, 2019. The news was produced with Oliver Sampson and Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.